everyone, and welcome to, this is actually the fifth ever podcast in the Edward Hutchinson podcast series. And if you guys haven't tuned in before, we actually kind of do this series just to kind of get a bit of an inside look into real estate, especially in LA, because that's obviously where we do a lot of business, and actually just meet different characters in different positions who actually have a different life in real estate, and I think that gives a lot of value to you guys. So anyway, welcome everyone. My name's Edward Hutchinson. I'm a real estate agent with Compass based on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. And today we are joined by two people, actually. Philip Braunstein, who is the president, Philip, yes, would you say? President of Colossal Properties.
El Presidente.
El Presidente, I like that. Maybe you should change that in your email signature. That would be amazing. And we're also joined by Clark Braunstein, who is the general counsel for Colossal Properties, but also is a real estate attorney and does things outside of it as well. So I've already said to Clark that we need to have him on for literally like a legal podcast at another stage.
Be happy to do it.
Yeah, because I think there's so much stuff behind that that people just don't really understand, or they hear a headline and it becomes this odd situation where they don't really understand.
A lot of lawsuits flying around the agents, some of the more prominent agents right now as well.
Definitely. And yeah, actually, weirdly, I heard a stat the other day, and let me know if this is right or not, Clark, that 75% of real estate legal lawsuits are in California in the whole of the US. And 50% of them are in California, and 75% of that 50% is in Southern California as opposed to Northern California.
Well, I would believe that statistic. Really? I haven't seen it before, but I do know that in Los Angeles is the most active and largest litigation community of lawsuits in the entire world. More lawsuits are filed in Los Angeles County than anywhere else in the world combined because of it. So, and there's a lot of real estate development, so there is a lot of lawsuits that relate to real estate. And so I could see it in Los Angeles.
So in your career path, is this the best location to be a real estate attorney?
Probably. Yeah,
right, in terms of payment and actually jobs.
But you also have a lot of competition too, because there are a lot of attorneys in California. Okay. So
yeah, because it is the suing culture.
Yeah.
Which is odd for me, actually, because like I come from London, and it's almost the opposite of what we do. I don't know why that is, and I'm still trying to work it out, because actually I think if someone's done something bad to you, you should have some ramifications to it. But we never seem to like open lawsuits or sue each other, yeah. But anyway, guys, give you a bit of background before actually we start asking these guys questions. Philip is the president of a luxury development firm in LA.
Yes. Philip Braunstein.
Yep.
Grew up in LA.
So you're LA native.
LA native.
Which is rare.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Born and raised in LA. Went to high school here, UCLA.
Oh, amazing.
For college.
Yep. Yeah.
And started in real estate in 2008, 2009.
So that was a great time to get into real estate in terms of the market.
Well, there was a lot of opportunity. There was a lot, it was right at the beginning of the Great Recession.
Yeah.
It was right at the beginning.
How was it at that time? Was that the reason you felt that you came into real estate at that time? Because there were deals?
There was a lot of, there was a lot of panic, a lot of hardship, but there was also a lot of investment opportunity.
Yeah.
And investors looking to capitalize on deflated pricing.
Yeah, and the foreclosures market that were kind of coming
exactly
up.
Exactly. Everyone was chasing foreclosures, not only LA money, but San Francisco money, New York money. A lot of the, you know, some of the BlackRock hedge fund style institutions were buying up, you know, huge tapes of foreclosures and renting them out, and have since then spun off IPOs just based on those purchases from starting back then.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, because actually, because I was in college at that time. Okay. So I was coming out 2010, 2011.
Okay, yeah.
So I kind of saw the London
market.
Yeah.
At the time, yeah, that was still soft.
But actually, weirdly, London, actually at the moment, we've got an incredibly soft market there.
Oh, really?
Because of Brexit and the uncertainty, I think. But weirdly, I used to always, my favorite stat about London property was that London prices had doubled every 10 years for the last 100 years in a row. Mm. So I was kind of like, when everyone was like, oh, the prices have gone up so much, you know, why should I buy now? I was like, look, you got to look at this long term and not
right,
like short term
right.
how it is. So yeah, Philip, so you got into real estate. You're from LA originally.
The market was very bad.
Yeah.
I remember talking to some real estate agents who pretty much felt they should have just gone on a vacation for the entire year because there were no deals to be done.
Yeah.
Reporting, you know, zeros on their tax returns.
And it went from like 100 to zero, wasn't it? Because I think 2007.
Yeah, 2007 was hot.
Yeah.
And I think maybe at the end of 2007 or beginning of 2008, it just went down. And so there was a lot of, you know, a lot of people trying to chase the deals.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It was very competitive at the time because even though people were struggling, the market was soft, there was a lot of, like I said, investors from all over the country and all over the world trying to purchase California real estate because they knew eventually it would rebound.
And then also you have the issue, too, is that the sellers at the time had these ideas in their mind of what the value was a year before. And so as like the market was tanking, they were refusing to realize, I'm going to get out of these investments. And so a lot of them held on way too long, which caused banks to foreclose on properties, which kind of exacerbated the problem. But I think that...
Last foreclosure, colossal purchase, was in 2000, God, I want to say 14?
Really?
And we haven't seen one since then.
Yeah, because I don't see them come up that much unless it's kind
of... Nothing you really want.
Yeah, it's small condo units that someone
bought. We bought a foreclosure from Wells Fargo, and like I think 2013, 2014 was the last time we bought one.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
So the market's been very buoyant.
So would you say that if you were giving me advice as an agent right now to make as many connections with people that are going to buy foreclosures if we do see a tanking in the economy?
Well,
in the next...
it won't be hard to find people who want to buy foreclosures.
Yeah.
That's true. Every guy at the pub will be saying, you know, do you have a way to pick up a foreclosure? Everyone's hot for a good deal.
So start specializing and have that covered. And don't be making the mistakes of 2007 agent.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is you got to watch, you really got to have relationships with the banks in order to have that in. So there's some agents who specialize in that, and the banks have the relationship.
Definitely. Yeah, because actually, but we also have, we have some like great relationships with some banks. Some banks, I actually just don't send my clients there for mortgages anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and generally, I don't want to mention anything on this, but it's the bigger kind of... conglomerate style banks where they've just got 1,000 people dealing with each transaction and it's a nightmare.
But the banks have also changed all their lending parameters and structures so may not see that flood of foreclosures we saw again because you know the loan to value ratios have changed.
Yeah.
You can't lend up to 90% on a property anymore like you could back then.
Weirdly though, actually I saw an article yesterday that one of my old colleagues in London, 100%.
Oh, nice.
Really?
They'll give you 100% mortgage.
In the UK
right now. And I was like, talk about like trying to ask for the same situations to go wrong again that we did last time.
Right.
It's like, do we not learn from our mistakes a little bit? But I don't know.
There's a tech company that will buy your house and let you live in it, rent it back.
Really?
And then if the property value increases, they'll split the profit with you when they go to sell it.
That's quite clever.
So you get the money for your house, you can live in your house. And if you feel like you're going to miss out one day on the future potential value, they'll split the profit with you.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I forget the name of the company, but I was just reading about it.
I mean, I think there's a lot of that kind of stuff evolving
starting
at the moment.
Come out.
Yeah, because actually, have you heard about Compass Concierge?
No.
So this is a new one that actually we've been told about. I haven't seen anyone in our office execute it yet. Mm-hmm. But effectively what they're saying is there's a huge amount of people out there that own a property that when it's staged and it looks amazing and the maintenance has been kept up to date, it's going to achieve a very good price. However, there's a huge amount of people that don't have the cash in their pocket to do the staging, the repainting.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So they'll give you an interest-free loan, which is repaid at closing.
So they're in the home improvement market then?
Apparently so.
Wow.
And then I always am thinking, like, what are the ramifications legally should that property not sell? Because presumably they're still liable for that amount of money. So.
We had this idea about 10 years ago.
Did you?
It was going to be called super staging. The idea was we'd come in, pay for the home improvements, up to 50, 100 grand, fix it all up, stage it, and sell it, and get like, you know, profit or commission participation.
Or split the profit in some way.
Yeah,
that's a really clever idea. Weirdly, I actually had an idea about a company a couple of years ago called Super Showings.
Okay.
Where my partner and I were turning around and saying... There's an odd situation where people spend like 25 minutes. I mean, when they're bigger properties like the stuff that you guys build, they'll come back for the sunset showing, like you were talking about before the podcast. But it's crazy to me that someone spends the most amount of money they're going to spend in their life on the biggest asset, and they spend less time in it than they do driving
so
a car.
It's like a weekend getaway.
Exactly. So we were going to basically build out like an Airbnb, but it's arranged through the local expert, the realtor, who effectively would put you in the property for 24 hours so you could experience it at 2 a.m. when the garbage truck's driving down behind.
Yeah.
And then that money would come out of the offer at closing.
The issue with that is I think it's a great idea.
But the liability warning
signs go off in my head about what happens if the guy has that party, stays in there, gets drunk, falls down, breaks 100%. His leg, And then, you know, you're on the hook for that.
And so, also now I think the big issue is because we've had these now short-term rental restrictions that have come in. Mm-hmm. So now it's 30-day minimum if you're in the city of LA.
Oh.
Coming from July 1st, so I'm very thankful that we didn't end up putting a lot of time and money into that, because that could have gone really badly. Okay, guys, sorry, we're getting off track, because actually, like, but I actually love that, because I think it's just good getting nuggets of information. So, you guys are both brothers, for everyone who's listening. So, you guys grew up both in LA, presumably.
Yeah.
Both went to school together, and was...
Through high school, yes.
Through high school?
Yeah.
And then you went to university here, Clark? Were you at university?
I went to university in San Francisco, at University of San Francisco up there. So I left LA for about 4 years.
So what was that? Were you flying back regularly? Because it's quite a short flight, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about an hour. I mean, I'd come back for holidays and things like that. But I was up in San Francisco just experiencing that what that city had to offer. I mean, I'm still an LA person when it was... At the end of the day, there's only about 800,000 people in the city of San Francisco.
It's small.
And I was there pre-tech bubble. Like, when I left San Francisco, Twitter had just signed the lease on Market Street to take over a building that was abandoned the entire 4 years I was living there. Like, a big 1920s, like, seven-story in downtown. And when I left, all the tech companies were like, oh, there's depressed real estate here because the economy had collapsed in 2008.
Yeah.
We can come into the city of San Francisco from San Jose. And then they basically started leasing up everything in downtown San Francisco. And then when that all inflated all the prices, they then came down to L.A. to Venice Beach.
To the
and
Silicon
that was about
Beach.
2 years later in 2010. So
that's crazy, because actually that's amazing to see. Because whenever I go back there, in fact, my wife's brother lives in Silicon Valley now, works for... It's actually worked for like a dental company. I was working for Machine Zone before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and actually it's quite crazy because you go there and it's almost this weird microcosm of like people who are all very interested in the same kind of things. But then I think there's a lot of people that like visit it because they hear about Silicon Valley.
Mm.
And it's not necessarily like the lifestyle that I think most people aspire to necessarily.
Right.
But I think that's going to be interesting, yeah, because we've seen that in Venice change massively. So when did you discover, Clark, that like real estate was going to be the... Because I suppose it's legal and real estate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of pushed together. Were you going down the legal road and then decided to go real estate, or?
Well, when you're in your first year of law school, you have to take property law.
Yeah.
It's like a requirement. It's one of the big ones that you have to take. It's like on the bar. And when I took that class, just the concepts like appealed to me. I enjoyed it a lot. I think the when you're studying the cases about property and learning about it, it came naturally to me, and I liked it. So it kind of... Throughout my studies of taking classes, I kind of just always dealt with real estate deals. And so when I came out and started practicing litigation, helping my brother with his company and doing the kind of the legal work to assist in that, it just kind of evolved and learned, and you build a skill set.
I think that's awesome. Because actually, I find that there's so many people in this world who do a job they hate. You know what I mean? Where actually you're Monday to Friday, like 70% of your life, you're doing this thing. And so I always think, like, if you're self-aware enough to realize what you actually enjoy dealing with, like, your life is so much less stressful and actually, like, doing things that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
But a lot of people just pick the money and they're like, okay, I'll go and work for a bank and I'll work 15 hours a day, and it's a bit of a nightmare.
Right.
So then you came back down to LA, hooked up with Philip, and kind of his plans at that time was to get into real estate, and then you guys were kind of working together to try and do that kind of stuff?
Well, I think I was in law school when you started building Dane at the Beach.
This
so
this was 10 years ago that I started, and I think you were in law school.
Yeah, because I graduated law school in 2011. You started Dane at the Beach in about 2010. So I was in my second or third year at that time while he was doing it. So I was kind of just, I was not providing like legal advice, because I think you were just, he was hitting the ground running.
He was just criticizing. That was his job at the time.
As you say, he's optimistic. Yeah.
But, I mean, so I think then once I graduated and passed the bar, I started working, because you then got your brokerage license.
Yeah.
After you, he went in, you raised the investment.
The plan was to integrate the construction and brokerage.
So you're going to do everything in the house?
That was the initial plan.
Okay.
And then it modified to just construction development.
What was the reason for that? Because I always actually wonder from my perspective.
To be honest with you, I was younger, and I was just fighting with every broker I hired. So at one point I was like, F them, I'm just going to do it myself.
I know what I want, I'm going to do it, so I'll do it better.
Since then I don't fight with the brokerage community.
Okay.
There was a, you know, a period of my life where I did. So like, you know how many showings you have, just real aggressive, real intense.
You want the
feedback, how many showings?
Communication.
You know, why didn't you get the offer? This is just crap offer. You know, it's just...
I love it.
Yeah.
So you were deciding at that stage, I'm actually sitting my broker's license next week, so I may have some questions for you on that after the podcast. So you decided, I'm going to do my broker's license, and you're going to sell your own properties.
Yeah, because I had gone through, I don't know if I should name names of the brokerage companies I tried to, you know, engage with, hired... Yeah. You know, they like took out an ad in the LA Times and they got the property address wrong. And then I'd just be like, are you kidding me? Like, and you don't really have that many listings to be, you know,
making that kind of mistake.
So a lot of things would trigger me, get me upset.
Yeah.
And so I went through one company, the next company. And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it myself. Because I'd seen the paperwork. You know, I'd gotten offers. I'd seen listing agreements. So I'm like, okay, I can
do that.
It's all, you know, I figured I could manage it. So I got my broker's license. And I started, you know, doing some work on some of the properties and brokeraging. And then for just reasons, I wanted to focus on the development. So I just kind of retired that component.
So it was kind of more that you didn't have enough time to do both.
Yeah.
As opposed
to... It wasn't really built out with, you know, an agent and a marketing team. It was more just an in-house kind of thing.
I always wonder about that as well from the side of if I was building, which I hope to one day, like you guys, my own property. If I'm doing a showing... Am I good at being that kind of impartial, did you ever have issues with it or like worry about that at all?
At the time, yeah, I mean, I don't think I worried about it at the time. Now I do.
Yeah.
Like there was reasons why, good reasons why I decided to not continue with that.
Okay.
And I pretty much has been inactive for quite a few years.
Okay. So you're never tempted to like go back and just... Do everything.
Well, I mean, the thought has crossed my mind, but like I said, it's not really, the infrastructure's not there to run it like a Compass, which is a nationwide company.
Definitely.
A lot of agents and the marketing and the advertising, so it's just not really set up.
Yeah, and I suppose to influence and like build that infrastructure plus the networking capabilities when it's in-house is really difficult.
The development for these houses, you know, it's 6 a.m., I'm texting site crew, subcontractors, and 7 p.m., you know, still thinking, oh, shoot, is the drywall guy coming tomorrow? You know, texting and calendaring. I mean, it's pretty much...
So you don't have time to,
12
like...
hours a day just to manage...
Well, actually,
all the components that go into the house.
And that actually filters really well into, like, one of the questions I was going to ask you. I think there's a lot of people out there who think, and they see the best moments of being a luxury developer because you build something that's very beautiful to 99.9% of the world. But what I don't think they know is like actually the day-to-day grind of being.
A grind.
So you're up at 6 a.m.?
Well, I'm up at 5 a.m., but I don't start texting people till 6.
I love that. It's out of just like courteous. Oh, you might be asleep till 6. Yeah, I love it. So up and up because you naturally wake up at 5 a.m.?
Yeah,
or up because you're like, I need to be up at that time to kind of get...
Just wake up early. I'm very sensitive to light.
Really?
Yeah, even the cable box light will wake me up.
Do you factor that into your properties at all? Like blackout curtains?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Yes. Good psychological read there.
Yeah. Because actually, like, I think about that quite a bit.
Yeah, we do. All our master bedrooms have full blackout shade systems, like in a, you know, high
Vegas.
End, like a Vegas hotel where you just hit the button and everything just blacks
goes down.
Out.
So you'll have your normal, just regular shade, and then you'll have a secret blackout one that makes it completely black.
So we have dual shading systems. One is the typical shading that you get
to stop the glare.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other one is a full blackout system,
which is
it's an additional like $100,000 cost, but you know, it's something I would appreciate.
Yeah,
because it's not easy to do blackout after the fact.
Definitely,
you have to open up drywall. You have to do a lot of stuff. So that we.
Oh yeah, because you're putting it inside that space.
You have to really black out every inch of the light to black it out.
When you guys see other competitive like companies building properties like that, a lot of them don't think about that kind of thing.
Well, I haven't seen it. I've looked at a lot of properties and I see usually cheap window treatments going
100% because it's all about profit.
Cheap. Yeah, but I see them do well too, so I guess the buyers aren't looking for it, or they're, you know, they get into a property and think this is exactly what I would look for, and then they sleep there one night and they're like, wake up the next day like it's bright in here.
I always say,
you know, and then they get their window treatment company and they're like, can you black this out? Like, no, we'd have to, you know, demo this and remove that. And they're like, and we don't have wiring for it, so you can't automate it. And they're like, you know,
I think you're basically like, just making the case for super showings to be a thing now.
Yeah.
Then they actually go and do it. But actually, like, yeah, because that is, I always say to my clients, because I've had lots of them before where they walk into the property the first time And I always find on the first showing for a property, it's all about, wow, how amazing is this?
Right.
When they come back a second time, so I always say at least see it two times.
Right.
Because when they come back the second time, they actually are thinking, okay, where's the storage?
Right.
What is actually living here going to be?
Where's the loo?
Where is the loo? Yeah. I love that. How close is it to my bedroom? Because I'm going to be up at night doing it. Because they don't think about the practicality, I think, as much when you're doing the first showing. Whereas when the second showing comes around, like, I always think that's so vital to get it done.
But yeah, it's a grind, and we try to integrate as many, you know, creature comforts like the blackout shades that we can
definitely
to make the house livable.
And that shower at Chicory is the other thing that I'm just like obsessed with that property.
Yeah.
Because like, what do they call it? Like party shower.
Yeah, Clark's idea.
Was it?
That was Clark's idea.
But it's just beautiful because the backdrop with that stone.
It's a panda marble imported from Italy. And I think in that bathroom alone, we used total, including the countertops.
Yeah.
And the panda marble book match was up to 30 slabs.
Jesus.
Yeah. So
when you're transporting that, you must be thinking, we do not want an accident here.
No. And it's actually book matched all, the whole thing's book matched. So yeah, there's a lot of marble and labor that went into just that bathroom.
And if you guys want to go and have a look at that property and what we're talking about here, it's Chicory Lane in Brentwood.
Yeah,
what's the number?
It's 1225 Chicory Lane.
1225. So go and Google that, guys. Have a look, and you'll definitely get to see kind of what we're talking about in terms
of
that.
So it's a daily grind, and Clark and I often coordinate and try to figure out, okay, if there's a dispute with the subcontractor or if there's ever a dispute with, is it a liability if so-and-so comes on the property, and what happens if they fall, what happens if they get hurt? The neighbor wants to use our driveway because they can't get a crane. Are we allowed to? What if their crane guy hits someone? So Clark and I then have meetings to go over all the liability that could come up on any of these properties.
That must be so valuable to have that as a family member in it.
Because
otherwise, I suppose you're paying a retainer fee, which presumably you get paid to do what you're doing, but you're constantly having to like reach out to a...
Yeah,
another...
or you end up in hot water if you don't have that, advice.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Also, one other thing too, it's a benefit of this, is like, I can be the bad guy. So Philip can always be the nice guy.
Good cop, bad cop.
Yeah, and he's like, and then, so I'll show up, and if I'll do a site visit, I'll go up, I'll wear a full suit, walk around, and like, be like, why isn't this done? And like, kind of put a little pressure on some of the guys there, because then they're like, oh great, the lawyer's here now, and then they start.
Yeah, Clark's become quite fond of the surprise site visit.
Oh,
he shows
really?
Up like in the policeman's sunglasses, walking around,
looking
on here. Oh, there's an exposed nail there. You got to turn that around.
Because that is a massive advantage. Because I suppose actually you kind of think, right, well, I'm running a company, I'm building properties. I need to have good relationships with my subcontractors. I need to be able to like communicate.
You can't fight with everyone. Mm-hmm.
And where do you draw that line of you've messed up, and I need
to
like actually tell you that we're not putting up with this? And so I suppose like having
it's quite good.
Yeah. What about on the other side of that, working with family members? Because I've always found like family businesses, everyone say, are fantastic, but it's obviously similarly like a bit of a blurred line there between when are we like brothers and hanging out and being friends, and when is this strictly just a business conversation?
Right.
Do you guys ever have difficulty with that, or you always find you've worked together really well?
You always got to find a balance so that you don't take advantage of family.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it comes down to is, Our parents worked together in a law firm together their whole life, too. So
you saw that.
So for us, it's not, to me, it's like he's my brother. It's like I have no problem telling him if he wants to do something. I'll be frank and honest with him. And I'll also give him my opinion. So it's not like we've ever butted heads here, because I think we understand the roles and the companies, and I'm here to facilitate the houses that are the best to be built. Like, that's my goal, is to succeed there. So it's not like I take my ego out of it. I think he takes his ego out of it, and I think he just wants to put a good product out there. I think that's the
Clark
key.
Clark is also an expert when it comes to these things, so it's more just listening.
Yeah.
Because he has expertise in the liability, the real estate law, also the employment aspects of what could be happening, the difference between employee and subcontractor, which was a big thing in real estate.
Definitely.
Recently, wasn't there a big lawsuit in San Francisco of a estate agent is defined as an employee or not?
Yeah, they went through that. I think that was recently. They changed it, which changed like the pay structure of certain agents that weren't...
Like a federal lawsuit.
Yeah,
right?
It was for FLSA, yeah.
Yeah, because I suppose that's actually the thing is you guys specialize in different areas. I suppose when I normally hear about like siblings working together in the same business, they're almost doing the same role, and it becomes this little bit of like, okay, well, I'm right on this. No, hold on, you're right. Whereas actually you guys are very... different specialities which work well together, and I suppose that's actually...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because I always think about that, because obviously my business partner is a close friend that I met in Bali in 2010.
Oh, nice.
And so we're always, like, I trust the guy like anything, it's awesome, but I definitely find that since we've been working together for the last 4 years, I don't spend that much social time with him.
Because you don't want to feel like it's work.
Definitely, and also, like, I feel like I see him most of the day, and it's kind of that situation where I'm like, okay, if we're seeing each other 24 hours a day, all day, every day,
right.
We're going to start grinding on each other in some way. So I'm kind of like, we definitely do social events and networking and things like that together, but definitely I kind of like to keep a bit of a boundary there, which is quite an odd one. Mm-hmm. But we do go surfing and call that like board meetings for like our... which, yeah, there's never that
much. Secretary making the notes of your meeting.
Yeah, she's my wife. I need to transition to that. So Clark, so is your morning similar, where actually you wake up at 5 a.m, you're texting people at 6 a.m, or is it different?
Oh, I'm awake usually around 6 o'clock. I'll wake up at that time. I'll start checking emails, and I'll respond to emails, or I'll respond to Philip's texts to me that I get, and I'll go through them, and then I try to do it. But I'm a big proponent of work-life boundaries, of me having, because the problem with when you're a lawyer, at least, you'll notice that everyone, if you have a problem with things, they'll send it to you and expect responses.
Instances.
So I will not, like, I'll try if it's late at night. I'm not going to look at my emails. Nothing. I'm not doing criminal law. I'm not doing things that nothing's ever going to be like the insane thing that I have to do. But then again, Phillip's called me. We've had issues. I remember a house. There was an issue. Like, the furnace didn't work.
Oh, yeah. That was a fun one.
Really?
Yeah. And so it's like, but I'll get a call. And he calls me. I'll answer because he's my brother. But it's like, he respects my boundaries, too. It's not like always like grinding on it. Because I think you need to realize when you're in this, there's a lot of stress at work.
Yeah.
You need time to unwind afterwards and not do it, or else it'll kill you.
Definitely.
You know?
100%.
You want to hear about this problem?
I want to hear about this problem,
So we had built a house in the Palisades, beautiful house.
Yeah.
It had gone, you know, family bought it and gone through all the inspections. Everything worked perfectly as we anticipated. Air conditioning, heating, everything was fine.
Yeah.
And they were moving in at the end of December, and were planning a New Year's Eve party. So they closed escrow on December 31st, and they have this big party. Everything, I checked down the inspections, and it was a little chilly that night, and I get a call at 10 p.m., or it wasn't that late, maybe 7 p.m., saying, you know, the heater doesn't work. And I said, oh, that's silly. You know, the heater works fine. We just had everything inspected. And they're like, no, it doesn't work. So I send, and trying to get someone from an HVAC company to...
Yeah.
Repair it on New Year's Eve was
impossible.
So no, I'm trying to call favors in from some of the guys I work with, like, hey, can you just go check this out? Maybe something simple,
like switching,
you know,
something on,
or, you know, the vents, something like that. So they go in there, and it turned out, so for some reason, the intake on the air intake had gotten clogged by someone like finishing a stucco thing and had clogged it with the intake. So it was a really simple fix, but it was like, I was freaking out because this person was so upset they weren't going to have heat for their New Year's Eve party.
Yeah, and I suppose there's a pride element to that as well. Like, you've created this thing.
Yeah.
Someone's showing it off to them.
And then I was so worried. I was calling Clark New Year's Eve, like, hey, I've got a problem. This person can't have their heat on. What's, you know? So it was a little stressful, but it was a simple solution. It was just...
And so you found someone who'd go and found it.
It was just an oversight on one of the workers having blocked it. So.
And I suppose that is...
They had gone through all the inspections, and so it was like... Thing that happened after the fact somehow. I don't remember how.
I think it was like a December heat wave before. Like, so when you get those, it was hot.
Yeah.
And then it was like the coldest night of December was New Year's that year. And so she was going to run it. And it was the first time she like ran it. And so I remember just trying to get it fixed. And we got it fixed. Like, that's one of the benefit, I think, of a smaller development boutique firm like us is that when he built the house, the issue that arose, immediately he had tried to have it fixed that night rather than... You know, if you go through some other developers, they'll be like, okay, we'll get to it later.
Some automatic email response will come back to you in the next 48 hours.
Submit your complaint on the online
portal. That must be great. So, but is that kind of your guys' life then? Because it seems like actually creating something beautiful must be pretty awesome and satisfying. Mm-hmm. But equally, is like actually a lot of your day-to-day and week-to-week is just fighting fires of, we've got an issue with this.
It's a good portion of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is setting up the kind of structure for you to be able to create the beauty, you know, which is all the stuff behind the scenes, making sure the framing is done correctly, the foundation is correct, the drywall is correct, so that when everything does come together, it kind of just fits in like a puzzle, versus being like, oh shoot, that's a little off, and now we got to, you know, rejigger everything.
And I suppose actually over time you just get better at that because you learn so from the mistakes.
Then the process becomes smoother. Yeah.
So how are you now, guys, compared to 2010?
Well, it's like the contractor I work with. Every
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Every day says, everyone gets better.
Yeah.
Everyone gets better.
Definitely.
So.
And that's where actually there's a huge amount of people, especially that we come across, that complain about stuff. And I kind of think you're just wasting your time and your energy instead of complaining.
Yeah.
Look at it. And just say, right, I've learnt my lesson and I'm not going to allow that to happen again. Or, you know, it's right. actually some value in it as right, opposed right, right. to just being this awful thing that happens.
Yeah.
But that's awesome. So day to day, how many site visits are you guys doing a week? I suppose it depends on the stage of construction you're in.
No, we do. I do daily site visits.
Every single site you're working on?
Yes.
Wow.
Sometimes not every single one every day, but definitely doing daily site visits as much of the sites as possible.
And what does that look like? You turn up, you say hi to the general contractor that's on site.
Either it will be a pre-scheduled meeting,
yep.
or if it's just showing up to check on things, show up, check in with the subcontractors on site, walk through. Hey, what happens? We run it through a daily calendar system, so we should know every sub, every event that's happening per site.
Wow.
So if I show up on a site, we're building a house on the Sunset Strip, and I look at my Google Calendar and it says, let's say waterproofing, shoring, steel framing. I can show up and look who's supposed to be there based on the calendar.
Yeah.
And if they're not there, then it's like, okay, let's get the site super here. Let's get on the horn. Where are you? Why aren't you here? Okay, sorry, you had a problem. You can come back tomorrow. We'll reschedule on the calendar. And that way it's kind of a quick way to, otherwise you're walking around the site, was the plumber supposed to show today? Was this supposed to happen today? And you can lose track. Because there could be 10 guys at a site, but not, the plumber, which is the one you wanted, and it's 10 drywall guys. And you just forget because you see the 10 drywall guys. So
to be a developer and build what the kind of scale you guys are building, you have to be an organized person.
This has a lot of organizational stuff involved.
There's no we'll just kind of hope that happens.
A lot of stuff can go wrong that way. It's big on, if I talk to my site super and he's like, yeah, he told me he's going to come tomorrow. I said, is it on the calendar? No, not yet.
Put it on the
calendar.
Right now.
Has to be on the calendar.
Yeah.
Because it's too easy to show up and just forget what's supposed to happen. You can't keep it all in your head.
And then I'll show up without unannounced visits. And I try to do every site at least once or twice a month just to show up when it's kind of the rough framing and things like that. I'll show up more when it's closer towards finished product, when you're doing the finishing.
Yeah.
But I'll show up in that way just so I can make sure, one, any safety issues are immediately addressed. So, and after I do it, I'll make a journal entry saying, I went to the site this day. I didn't see, there were everyone was wearing hard hats. Everything was like that, which is in the case if there ever is any litigation. I always have my notes that show I came on this date. Everything was compliant based on me. And I'm by no means an expert on OSHA or anything like that. But it's still, there's a system in place to make sure that that's done. If guys aren't wearing a safety harness, I'll go to the contractor, I'll go to the guy, I'm like, why isn't he on a safety harness? Really? Put him on that, And then I don't like to go as much too, because at the end of the product, I'll have fresh eyes more than everyone else.
Yeah.
So when we're doing like a walkthrough or a punch list, when it's drywall's up, they're painting, I'm the one that walks around and I'll be like, that's like an eighth of an inch crooked, that line right there. And they'll be like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you've been looking at it for 2 years. There's a crookedness that you don't see because you're used to it now.
Yeah.
And then, so I kind of walk through and I'm like, and I try to be that buyer, that high net worth buyer that's going to be A-type and see those flaws. And I say, look, I'm pointing this all out. You can tell me we're not going to fix that or that's not an issue, but I want you to know that it's there and I want them to fix those things. And so...
That is massive value, actually. So you almost don't want to go too regularly. You want to be like going with gaps in between so that you're seeing the changes and have fresh eyeballs on it.
That does help.
Yeah, I can imagine that's actually really useful.
There was an incident a year ago in Brentwood. I can't name the property address, but where someone got so badly injured, they had to be airlifted out.
Not one
of my projects. But in Brentwood, it happened where someone was so badly injured that they airlifted out.
They fell off scaffolding.
Yeah, they fell off scaffolding and were impaled by rebar.
Do you guys have to have insurance in place for that, presumably?
Massive insurance policy.
I was going to say, yeah.
Massive. One of our insurance policy alone costs $250,000.
Per year.
It's a 10-year policy.
Okay, I was going to say that. It's just, how do you ever make money? Yeah, so, but still, $25,000 a year for 10 years is a lot. What about...
That's just one of them, though.
Do you have to have some form of earthquake insurance?
That's optional. You know what? I actually don't like earthquake insurance for my properties because they're all engineered to sustain massive earthquakes based on most recent engineering.
Yeah, because you're putting the pylons that you're down.
Yeah, if my projects can't sustain an earthquake, it's like science is not doing a good job.
Yeah.
Because this is all calculated out based on, okay, you know, the earth's going to move like this, and can this project handle it? I mean, this is all 2014 engineering, but, you know, some of them have 2018 engineering. Yeah. This is all new stuff.
When was that... Did you see that emerge as a trend? Because I always, when I see construction sites and the luxury lots with obviously amazing views, a lot of them have drop-offs there.
Yeah.
And so you're putting like pylons as far down into the ground as you can possibly almost go so that it is rooted in that. Has that always been the case since you've lived in LA that you've known that that was the way they did it? Or before was it kind of, let's just put a light thing on top and hope it's...
I think that was pretty much the standard, but, you know, caissons can go deep and still fail. There's been... Los Feliz has had some problems. There's always some cases of, you know, failure of the foundation.
It really depends on the soils engineer.
Yeah, having a good soils engineer makes
is key for any hillside development, because their job is basically to look at the ground, tell you how many caissons you need, how deep they're supposed to go.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know... Some developers, they may, you know, want to go with the cheapest soils engineer. They're like, I don't care. I'm just going to put this up.
It's just soil.
Yeah, it's just soil. It doesn't matter.
It's only what
I'm
going to
do, because caissons are expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, foundations are expensive. Concrete's expensive. And if you don't get the best for these homes, they're going to be, oh, you know, I'm going to do cheap, because that's going to be in your bottom line. You're going to profit. But what a lot of them don't realize is if there is a failure in a caisson, and it is a developer's fault, not the house. The house has its fixed cost to remake it.
Yeah.
It's the expensive stuff inside the house that you're going to be liable for.
I see.
So that's where people are like, well, okay, you know, I look at my budget. It cost me X amount to build this house. That's my liability. But that's not where the number is going to come from. It's from the fancy piece of artwork
on the wall
that gets broken.
$10 million.
Yeah. I had a developer friend who was sued. The roofing failed and the leak happened. To patch the roof and fix that was $5,000. But when the leak happened, it flooded all the furniture in the home. And the furniture was valued, it was a $5 million home, furniture was valued at $250,000.
So
the lawsuit was for the $5,000 patchwork, it was for the $250,000 of furniture, and he lost. And he owes him $250,000.
Which is kind of fair as well, though. You kind of look at it and I'm like,
happy.
If I bought a new house and they had a leak...
He's not happy about that.
That's true.
Yeah,
because I didn't even think about that. Actually.
Yeah, because a lot of developers or people think, oh, you know, I know how much it makes to build this house. I can build that. But that's not where the damages always come from. It's what happens inside the house. And what they put inside the house. And then that is what gets expensive. Because if you're building high-end luxury homes... The people are going to have expensive things inside of it.
100%.
Couple room brands.
You know.
Well, and I suppose that's the thing with, like, your guys, what you build specifically. Like, obviously, if someone's building a multi-unit condo building and they're selling for $150,000 and there's some damage that happens, the person's belongings probably aren't the same value if they're buying that. Equally, they probably don't have, like, their personal lawyer who is going to be turning around saying, hold on a second, you sue the crap out of these guys.
I remember once, Philip sold a house once. To a high net worth individual.
Yeah.
And 6 months later, we get a letter from the lawyer about a city fee of, I think, $25.
Yeah.
For tree trimming or something.
It was a $25.
$25?
And she had a lawyer that was probably...
Three-page letter from the lawyer.
For about $1,000 an hour lawyer, she had to write a letter to us saying that we had to pay this $25 fee.
This fee dates back to prior to the close of escrow, so you are responsible for the $25 brush clearing fee.
Are you joking?
Because I opened the letter and I'm like, oh my god, I have a 3-page letter for a lawyer. I'm reading it. I'm like,
$25?
Okay, give this to the secretary and write the check.
And then I wrote a 1-page email, like a 1-quick email response. We paid the fee. Does that resolve everything?
Thanks for all the time you put into this. A phone call would have made that happen. Yeah. I mean, that is mental. Like, but my head straight away then goes to, that person, that's how they became wealthy, was nickel and diming the shit out of like every situation.
It could be.
To the point where...
I can't really disclose too many details of their identity.
That is incredible.
But they spent $1,025 on the lawyer.
On the lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah.
The thing.
So it's almost, yeah, it's like, what the hell are you doing? Oh my God, that's amazing. Okay, guys, so... I think we've got a really good take on actually what your day-to-day life is,
yes.
Kind of what it is, and it seems like it's incredibly stressful, but presumably the rewards are pretty awesome.
That's the idea.
Yeah, you get to see some pretty amazing places, make some incredible connections with people, I presume, mm-hmm. kind of dealing with the markets you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think about the market for the next couple of years in LA? And I always say this on the podcast, which is none of us are, like, we cannot tell the future. Mm-hmm. We don't know what is going to happen, but obviously we do see trends emerge and we kind of see things. And I think obviously you guys, actually that's a good question to start with. Do you guys ever build something that's not kind of super high-end luxury, or have you done like that in the past?
No.
So it's always like
it's
the wow
luxury,
properties.
Yeah.
So
never done any tract homes or low income or never.
So I suppose actually that's almost something that plays into it. And for a lot of you guys out there listening, if you're not kind of used to how real estate works, there is definitely a difference in terms of what happens when you're selling a property which is very much high end of the market, as opposed to your bread and butter of the market, which in our areas of LA is like 1 to 6 million now, kind of.
Right.
Which
kind
is
crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that obviously not most people can afford a property at that value, but a lot of people can afford a property at that value. So it plays a lot more in the supply and demand kind of demographics, supply and demand kind of situation of the market. What do you guys think about that side of the market? And what do you think about like luxury? Because you're building 4 projects at the moment.
Right now we have 4 under construction.
Under construction.
Mm-hmm. That will all be valued over $10 million, in the $10 to $20 million range.
Okay. So like for everyone out there, that in LA is definitely the high end, but there is also...
The super high end, is, you know, the 20, 30 and up.
And we're seeing like 100 mil plus on some now.
Plus,
yeah.
Which I just like to say to all the people watching this, it'd be nice to see someone step up and buy one of the 100 mil pluses in LA.
Especially after that
Elon
new
Musk,
one.
If you're listening, step up and buy one. Quit buying the junk you're buying in Bel Air.
Yeah.
$2 to $3 million homes next to each other. Step and buy some, you know, some
big.
Let's go.
We want the big purchase prize.
Yeah,
we want to give some property tax to LA.
Let's get a kick
Jeff
off.
Bezos, new home.
Yeah,
come out
on.
Here.
You got divorced. You know, let's go. Let's kick off like $150, $200 million sale.
Although actually,
you mentioned earlier before that there was just a $240 million sale of the condo.
Yeah.
And that's a condo. Let's get a big Bel
Air
bill and use Ed Hutch.
Yeah.
You know,
use me to come and purchase it. In fact, yeah, Bezos was seen in Felix in Venice right by my house,
yeah,
I think, when it was first
Bezos
caught. So
reach
I need
out to Ed.
Yeah. Please, yeah, come through me. We'll spend a little bit of your $140
billion
on something.
$1 million commission.
But I'm definitely seeing that as a trend, because I think that there was, I don't know, because you probably know it a lot better than I do being in this market, there was a lot of people who were not building things of ridiculous value. It seems over the last 4 years we've had 160 million, 180 million, a 250, we've got a 500 million,
coming
which is
up,
in the works.
Yeah.
So is there something that we're just not aware of there?
I think we're going to learn what the market can bear.
Yeah.
You know, the next 24 months, probably.
But because some of those, we're seeing big price reductions. The 250 is now 160.
150.
Yeah.
So
I'm kind of thinking you've done a $100 million reduction in price.
Yes.
But you look at the profit margins on those bigger homes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of room to reduce it. And I think that the market, you know, if you're going to buy a $100 plus million house,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to just throw your money away at something you love.
Yeah.
You know? So you're going to look at it and see, is this worth my investment? And I think that pre-2018, I think maybe there were high net worth individuals who didn't want to pay. You know, that was a property tax write-off.
Yeah.
They don't have that anymore.
Yeah, because of the tax law changes.
The tax law change, to me, I think it's going to have the biggest effect on those ultra-luxury plus $100 million homes, because you're not going to be able to write off those, that your property tax, rather than give it to Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
You now can basically say, okay, well, you know, instead of paying taxes on this, I get to write this off. So that's why you have it. But if you don't have that deduction on the super high end, it's going to impact it. I mean, I think that everyday mom and pops in the sub 5 million, it may not have the same kind of impact for them. But when you're up there and it's not your second home, your third home, your fourth home, that's when it starts to add up that you can't deduct those taxes.
Definitely.
In your income.
And for everyone out there listening as well, like, you're paying between like 1% and 2% really on average
a
year.
1.25%, yeah, 1.25% of the sales price.
Which is like, which is kind of great. I like about California how it's not reassessed, almost it's done on the purchase price with limits.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to change.
Is it?
Yeah. That it's gonna, they're wow. going, because the new governor wants to alter it to say that commercial properties will get reassessed every 3 years.
That's right, yeah.
Doesn't matter, there won't be any mom and pop exception. It'll be, if you have a commercial property, you get reassessed every 3 years. Now, they haven't released the full language of that bill, but that's where it's going to be going, because that's going to be for those, you know, strip malls and things
yeah.
like that. But then does it apply to the duplexes? Does it apply to the person
yeah.
that has that Airbnb's their
the
guest house?
Unit,
is that
yeah.
a commercial one? Is that going to cause it to be reassessed?
And I suppose that's probably an indicator of where it could go residentially
mm-hmm.
after that as well, a couple of years down the line, and people are like, well... Because I always think... Because that's the weird thing for me is we have a thing in, as I'm sure you may know, in London... where when you buy the property, you have a thing called stamp duty, where you're almost paying a percentage of the purchase price depending on the value, and it scales up
mm-hmm.
at the point of purchasing. So it's almost like a barrier to entry for people.
Mm-hmm.
However, your property tax is not really done on the purchase price. It's done on the number of bedrooms and the area you're in. So I bought a property in 2012 at like £1 million,
mm-hmm.
and that I was paying, I'm still paying £1,400 a year in property tax.
Oh, wow. Very
so,
affordable.
Exactly. And so I'm kind of thinking you make that jump and obviously you're taking the hit early on. But long-term wise, it plays out really well.
Yeah.
And then I look at some states in the US and I'm like, where they're reassessed every year. And I'm thinking, you buy in a gentrifying area, fast forward 5 years, you're in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you've done anything, but just because you made a good decision to buy a property that's valued
right.
at whatever it is, suddenly you can't afford your 20 grand a year property tax.
Right.
So you've got to move. Like, which is kind of like gentrifying on steroids almost in a
yeah.
weird, like, odd way.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interesting.
But yeah, we're going to find out about this, the end of the spectrum, ultra-high-end market, what it really looks like in Los Angeles pretty soon.
Yeah.
Because either these high-end properties are going to sell at a low price, or they're not, and then people are going to stop building them. Because there's, I don't think anyone's really tried to build and sell such large properties at such high prices before, so... We're going to figure out if there's a market for it. People are going to keep building them or scale back.
Yeah, because they're going to that supply and demand kind of
right,
thing.
So if there's no demand for it, they're going to have to build something else.
Do you guys ever have that when you build it out into your, when you're like drawing your lines, you're like, this is kind of what we think the build cost is going
to
be?
Yeah, yeah. We, you know, we try to scale it to the market and to the site. So we're building a 13,000, the biggest house we're building right now is a 13,000 square foot house on Sunset Boulevard. I could have built up to 18,000 if I had done a basement.
Really?
And I was doing it, and I had an awesome basement design. I was thinking, this is going to be so cool. Like, this is going to be something people haven't seen in Brentwood here for a while.
Yeah.
And as I was going through the build costs, it started to look a little bit like, you know, it could get risky.
Yeah.
If it didn't sell or didn't sell fast.
Because I suppose, yeah, you add that extra 6,000
yeah.
square feet, and then you're in a price point per square
be,
foot. That's,
exactly.
Yeah.
So the cost, and I was like, you know what? So we scaled back. We ended up with a two-story home around
mm-hmm.
13,000 square feet. Still going to be really nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, decided to... not just go for as much as I could build.
And I suppose actually probably a huge amount of the cost of building would be doing the subterranean because you're
that
putting retaining walls.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, not just that. When you do subterranean, if you have to remove more than, what is it, 500 cubic yards?
I think now it's 800, no, 1,000.
1,000
yeah.
1,000 cubic yards of dirt, you have to get a haul route permit from the city of Los Angeles, which is not a ministerial act in the sense that there's actually a public hearing. You have
it's
to go down... The neighbors get notified by
it. Oh, they get
it.
That little letter
yeah. And they'll
door.
Show up.
Yeah.
Because the not in my backyard crowd, they have this psychological issue with digging in the ground. They
yeah.
think it's
Mark and I had to go for 3 hearings plus a meeting, town hall meeting, for a haul route we had approved on a Tiger Tail Road project.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the people that are turning up to those meetings aren't the ones to support what you're doing.
No, I mean, the problem with, is when these, they turn into popularity contests at times, but I think that Our council member for LA, I think their office was really helpful in kind of facilitating it, giving everyone an opportunity to talk.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some developers won't even show up. They're like, you know what, I'm not going to try and do this. But I think we try to engage the community to see, get their feedback and have a good conversation with them. Sometimes they may not, they just don't want you to build. And you can't really have a conversation with someone whose position is unable to have any flexibility. Yeah. But we try to engage them. We go through the process. You show up down there. You get people to show up.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself can put a lot of risk in your project. Because if someone gets to the plum committee, gets to city building and safety, there's a number of things they can do which can stall your permitting process.
And then you're carrying costs presumably over that time because, you're having to pay your property taxes while you're holding that property and also your construction costs.
And what happened is I think it leads to some of the issues with downtown LA in the pay for play where they make payments to get things approved. There's a common thing right now where certain city council members in LA will make deals with developers to make donations to charities in exchange for community approval, which is now kind of getting under scrutiny. I think Councilman Ryu wants to stop that entirely.
Because it's almost lobbying in some kind of like odd way, isn't it? And I suppose I bet there's some like weird charities that are set up.
Bribery cases going on with residential home builders. I'm not going to mention a name.
Yeah.
But the house on Stratovecchia in Bel Air.
Really?
Yeah, that's the current lawsuit right
the
there.
The FBI is involved that plan checkers, inspectors, and deputy inspectors are paid off by the developer. This is alleged.
In the complaint.
In the complaint. And the FBI investigation paid them off in order to get a bigger house that would have legally been approved by the city.
But then the city though did tell that developer to tear down the top story.
Yes, I don't know if it was the top story.
Or one of the stories.
One of the stories, they have a forced demolition portion of the house.
But especially when you spent that much on the materials. Jesus.
Which goes to tell the audience to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Play by the rules.
Play the long-term game, not the short-term.
You don't want to be ripping out your own house later on.
But the interesting thing about that is after the court issued the order to demo that part of the house, the neighbors below filed an injunction to stop the demo that the other neighbors wanted to do because they were concerned about the demo being done by the developer and they thought it'd be too dangerous on them below.
Yeah, a big piece of concrete fall on your head when you're taking a swim.
So that's just, now you have two neighbors fighting over the
insane.
The same developer.
Because I suppose actually then it becomes a situation in those super high-end luxury areas where
everyone's rich.
Everyone's rich and you want to be, you almost need to be very nice to everyone because when they start like talking behind your back about, oh, well, that guy that built that one, oh, you don't want to go in it. Like, it's really bad for your business.
Right.
So you guys have to be people pleasers as well as like mathematicians and designers.
It's always good to have community outreach is the technical term. Community outreach, neighborhood, you know, good communication. Make sure, you know, if they have a complaint, listen.
Yeah.
I mean, Philip's gone door to door with plans before.
Yes. Really?
Knocked on every day, would go say, hey, would you like to see what I'm building? Here are the renderings. Yes.
That
you know,
is so good.
Yes.
You know,
door-to-door.
Here's my number if there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I'm building next door to you. Just want to give you a heads up. Here's my number. Was there anything you'd like to discuss now?
Yeah.
And some neighbors said, oh, could you try not to park too much in front of my house? Or you like this? Like, okay, you know, chit chat.
I'd say it goes back to, I think, communication really is everything. Like, that's
and then
where
a neighbor called me and said, oh, could you build my house one day? I'm looking into doing it. So they'd appreciate it.
And actually, yeah, it's more business for you, actually, because
Actually
building strong relationships
with
people. Have you ever done something, because we've seen it a little bit in Venice before, where obviously the lot sizes are very small at around 5,000 square feet.
Yeah.
And you've built stuff there before?
Yes.
From our last
I had an 8,000 square foot lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the bigger ones.
Big, yeah.
But I've seen recently some of the ones where there's a developer who'll build a like luxury, lovely house on one of those lots. They'll knock down what's there. They'll put in fencing and landscaping for the two lots on either side to the neighbors to almost keep them happy through that construction process and say, look, we're going to be putting in a fence anyway. We'd like to just kind of see what you want.
Yes.
You choose it. Have you guys ever done stuff like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
We've worked with neighbors where we'll put in the fencing at the beginning so they get a sense of, you know, privacy and something nice. So they don't have to look at, you know, a construction fence for 24 months.
Yeah, and I suppose actually you're selling a product to someone who's going to live in that location most of the time. And so they need to be on good terms with their neighbor.
Right.
And not, thank God you bought this, the developer.
Although the worst nightmare case I had with a neighbor was a neighbor, and if you're listening, you know, I have forgotten about it, who shot out all the windows of a newly built house.
Mm-hmm. With a gun.
With a gun.
With a BB gun.
I was going to say. Like,
you guys always ruin the
Well, no, that neighbor also attempted to try and run over
attempted murder as well on one of the workers.
Like, tried, and then when it was going for sale.
Assault with a deadly weapon, not attempted murder. It was because the neighbor tried to run over the worker, so it's assault with deadly weapon.
That's mental.
Yeah.
We had built a house. Everything was permitted, allowed by the city, no monkey business. And the neighbor, it was an area of Brentwood where they just had not had big houses built. And it was a 6,500 square foot house. So in the grand scheme of what's being built in L.A., it's
not massive.
No, it's not even on the radar.
Yeah.
So, but to this neighbor, it was like a horrible thing. So one night, and I had cameras on the property, one night when it was raining, so the visibility was low, the neighbor shot out all the brand new windows that were installed. So I had to get all the windows replaced.
It must have been a pretty powerful BB gun to do that.
Yeah, quite powerful, yeah, exactly.
Like, if it goes through a window, it's going to go through
skin. That was one of the more depressing days, is to show up on the job site.
And all the water had gotten in.
Oh, yeah, something brand new. Yeah, because it was raining.
It rained as well.
Yeah, so you're putting in all this work, and then you see it, you know, destroyed in front of you. It was not a nice feeling. And then that same person tried to run over one of the workers.
So did they just deny it when you go to them and say, did you shoot out my window?
Well, I had the police get involved, and they denied it, and the camera footage was poor, so...
You just kind of move on, I suppose.
This neighbor also, when it was finally put on the market, took like a sheet and painted like Helm for sale to developer,
$10 million,
and like hung it out on their garage or something insane like that during it, which is, you know, and it's interesting because so what I found interesting about some of those people that, you know, they've owned this house probably since the 70s or 60s when those tracks were first built.
Yeah.
And, you know, when those tracks were first built at that time, they didn't allow minorities to live there. They had the restrictive covenants. Yeah. So it's like, you know, you had these older generation of owners who they had access to this American dream. Yet then they tried to prevent anyone else from doing it themselves, which I find to be a bit hypocritical.
Crazy.
You know, it's like, this is an evolving city.
Yeah.
It's growing. We need housing.
And the USA is like a country of immigrants, almost. Like, it's kind of, you've got these incredible people from all these places.
And I think LA will be the dominant financial city in the US in the next 5 years or so, maybe 10 years. I think no one's going to want to live in New York.
I think you're 100% right. We're seeing a huge amount of that East to West Coast movement.
With the internet and the video conferencing and, you know, I think...
Work remotely in the sunshine.
I think it's going to start moving more over here.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
I think once the trade... deal with China resolves and the proximity to Asia versus on the East Coast, I think that's just going to, the one and two economies are just going to start to gel and more and more people here in LA doing business. So we need to get some of those big homes sold.
Yeah. To set those records.
It'd be good, yeah. A couple $100 million, maybe $125 million be good.
Yeah. I think, I would love to see that going down at the moment.
Be a good one,
But I suppose, actually, weirdly, so we sold a property in San Francisco end of last year, and actually on that covenant thing, that came up in the disclosures, is that covenant was there, but obviously, and my clients were like, what the hell is this? And we're like, no, that doesn't count for anything, it just comes up
in
the disclosure.
Yeah, well, it's really frequent in a lot of parts of L.A.
Really?
You think a lot of parts of...
It's moot, though, by a civil
basically. Yeah. So, like,
it's not enforceable.
Yeah, it's unenforceable, exactly, but those covenants, I mean, you think about it, like even the hippie commune of Crestwood Hills Association, the lower tract had an entire... It was built by socialists where everyone agreed to pay each other's mortgage if they went in default. It's on the... And, like, it's a bunch of musicians post-war, but they had racially restricted covenants, too. So you see them throughout Los Angeles. And it's, you know... And I think that a lot of those restrictive covenants they're not valid anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in essence, a lot of them also had restrictions on what you could build. And those are all slowly disappearing right now.
Yeah, because they are releasing some of those, aren't they? Because I know, like, Coastal Commission, we always find for, like, Venice and our area.
Oh, yeah.
And Pacific Palisades, I presume, as well. Same thing. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Because they just love to just say no to everything. It's kind of,
And I think it goes back, though, to Bill's point earlier about community relations.
Yeah.
Because even if you are building in an area that has a architectural committee, has a, you know, historic preservation overlay zone, or has something in there... I don't think people should be afraid of going into it.
Yeah.
I think they just have to be confident in what they're doing and try and kind of push through it.
Yeah.
I mean, we've built in places with architectural committees. We've pushed through it. We deal with community. You just kind of... There's two approaches. Some developers will say, I'm not going to deal with it. I'm just going to do what I want and let them sue me. And then I think we've taken the approach of minimize litigation, work with the community, but don't be a pushover. Understand and go forward through it, and then you can get it built and you can make some money and do it.
In fact, actually, I think when we met briefly last week, Philip, you were saying that there was a lot that you picked up where the person that was selling it kind of thought this was the maximum, and you looked at it and were like, hold on a second, I think you could probably do more.
Yes.
And that's that, like, pushing it and actually like figuring it out, as opposed to just being like, no, okay, fine, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's actually where the benefits come from, I think.
Yeah, that one we're building an 8,000 square foot house on.
Yeah.
Architectural residence.
That's going to be insane.
Yeah, it's going to be quite. That will be done in late spring of this year, actually.
Yeah.
So we'll have to do a tour.
We will.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
Tour, yeah.
Okay, cool. So actually, we're coming up to an hour now. So actually, I just thought we've actually kind of... I had put a load of questions down, guys. And actually, I've never been able to get to them just because we're going into these like incredible like discussions of other things. So we kind of actually talked about your future. You're working on four projects at the moment. With the market in that way, are you just kind of looking at it like we continue to just find projects or slow down?
Well, you know what? Even though there are, you hear about all these high-end residences coming up in the market for sale, or some of them not selling and the inventory increasing, and you hear a lot of warning signs about it, there's actually not that many land deals you can just go pick up. If you're, let's say you want to go build a high-end luxury home and you're a buyer, it's not like, okay, let me see, 1 acre, ocean view, can build 20,000 square feet in Beverly Hills, Brentwood, Bel Air. Okay, make it happen under 10 million.
Yeah.
Like, send me the list.
Yeah, it's not.
This is not going to happen.
Yeah.
So the thing is we're actually constricted on how much we can expand the business by the lots available.
Okay.
Or the teardowns available. You know, I call them lots, but, you know, parcels of land, teardown homes that are available to actually buy that can accommodate a large luxury residence.
Yeah, okay.
So, and I think people are, you know, I think people like to live in their homes and stay in their homes, so.
Would you ever kind of have that thought of like, okay, well, we don't have the equity or we don't want to deploy the equity right now to develop it fully, but we will buy it because we think in like 4 or 5 years it's going to be even harder to find.
So that was my strategy for a while, is that if there was a lot of a piece of land available that you could build a large luxury home to buy it because there was limited supply.
Yeah.
You know, how many pieces of land can you buy? That was actually how the Sunset property, because typically I avoid properties on Sunset Boulevard, just because there's a little bit of a stigma, which I found not really fair, but there is the stigma out there. And it was, you know, a 30,000 square foot lot, 20,000 square feet of it was a flat. We could build up to 18,000 square feet. We ended up only building 13,000, but, you know, again, go find that, you know, opportunity again for that, you know, that price point to do all this stuff in Brentwood or, you know, another primary of LA. And it's just...
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah, because I suppose it's not completely easy. Limited supply and you cannot reproduce it.
That's
like, land
thing.
Is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing.
It actually kind of weirdly like puts my mind onto where I got married, which is on the market at the moment, which is Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a billion-dollar...
billion-dollar Aaron Kerman listing, which kind of you just think, like, $1 billion for a piece of land
for
is
land,
mental.
Yeah.
But then you kind of think, okay, well, the valuing of that comes from you're never going to be able to do anything like it again.
Yeah.
So how much value is there in that? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, those big... There are a few big areas of land. And if you were a developer that had the capital to and the time, and you're willing to subdivide it, create the roads, get
Clark's
the utility...
a big proponent of this one... $150 million land listing off Coldwater Canyon. It's like 150 acres, maybe a little
I think I've
less.
Heard of that one, yeah.
I mean, and so if you,
really
you know, you put together, I mean, the key is getting a financial deal. I mean, what I think happened is once the market collapsed, all the big publicly traded tract home houses left California, and they really haven't come back. And so if you wanted to do that, but on a scale of high-end luxury homes, rather than on a tract listing of what I think the last one is KB's doing down in Playa Vista, where they're building those townhomes and things.
Yeah.
But you do that, but instead you have acre-sized lots. You have, you know, 10,000 square foot homes on these gated communities.
Yeah.
Those are areas you could do, but it's going to be you're going to be pushing against a lot of headwinds.
Yeah, definitely.
To get it done. I mean, I think the last one that was done was kind of in Brentwood, and they ended up having to give, I think, like 10 or 15 acres to Santa Monica Conservatory.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the gated community off Mandeville.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally owned by the Hilton family.
Oh, really?
And they sold it to a development company. Tom Brady built his chateau there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was amazing lots. It was a subdivision of maybe 20 homes. It's in a guard-gated thing. You go to Mandeville, you turn around in Chillon.
Yeah.
Guard-gated, and it's really cool houses. All Mediterranean style.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
But in order to get that built, they actually had to give a huge portion
of the land.
To the Santa Monica Mountain Conservatory to not be built on. But I think that that mindset will be changing, though, because of the housing that needs to get built in California. I mean, in L.A., too. I mean, eventually, it's just you either build up or you just start building in these areas.
Definitely. Because actually, yeah, you look at, like, rental prices and how they are just insane here.
Yeah.
And it's because there's just so much demand for, like, very limited supply. Mm-hmm. And so we need to really be producing more.
That chateau that Tom Brady built, he needs a new lawyer because he actually built the house with no contract with the developer. Just oral agreement. And it was a $15 million budget.
And hasn't paid or paid and then the contractors...
Well, I don't ever know what happened with the whole details, but I know the developer, and he says they argued on the contract for 3 months and their attorneys couldn't come to an agreement. So Tom Brady just called him and says, I'm not signing it. We can't come to an agreement. I'm just going to wire you the money. Wired him $15 million.
That is incredible.
I don't know how much it went over budget. I'm sure it did. But that was direct from the developer.
I mean, that's some goodwill there on a handshake, wiring him $15 million.
Would have fired him as a client.
you're out. Oh my god.
So
yeah,
we got to get shout outs to Bezos, Musk,
definitely.
Tom Brady. Let them know that we're talking about.
Come by Mountain and then have Colossal build you out some 200,000 square foot behemoth. That is fascinating. I'm really excited just to see actually how that plays out. So we're thinking hopefully we'll get some, in the future we'll have some of those high profile properties bought because we think LA is going to become almost that kind of central hub.
Yeah.
Because it's got incredible city life, it's got sun, you're kind of on the beach and actually you've got close proximity to Asia.
Yeah.
And also, you can go snowboarding too.
100%.
We're
thinking about doing a piece of content where we're going to do the boards in one day thing. Like go and skate, then skate park, go and snowboard, and then go and surf all in the same day. Because there's not many places in the world you can do that. Okay, guys, so I think we can kind of round that up. Is there anything that you guys wanted to kind of put out there or any predictions right now? Because when this podcast becomes 10 million people listening every week in a couple of years, it'd be quite cool to look back and say, I predicted anything. But I suppose actually, you guys just track with what's going on in the market. You're building what you're building. It's always really well received from, my perspective, which I think is amazing because there's definitely a lot of developers out there where the stuff isn't that well received. But is there anything out there you want to get out there to the people of the world at all?
I just think that there's going to be a time period where the high-end luxuries become very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's going to be a few purchases that kind of grow some confidence, and then it'll kind of level out and be a kind of normal, not stagnant, but healthy market.
For the next,
May not be crazy, but it also will be healthy enough where properties will be able to buy and sell.
Yeah, okay.
Which
so,
you want.
Which is perfect for
which
us.
What you want.
Yeah, we just want more transactions as much as possible.
Exactly.
And kind of, okay, guys, I think we've got some really cool plans, everyone out there listening, because I think we're going to do some tours of actually the sites that these guys are doing. So definitely subscribe to the YouTube channel. Follow us on Instagram, Hutch Johnston. These guys as well, Colossal, have got a really cool Instagram account where actually you're documenting quite a lot of what you're doing visiting the sites as well as actually what the finished product looks like.
Yes.
So if people want to go and follow you, Philip and Clark, the accounts that they should go and follow.
They should go to @ColossalProperties.
@ColossalProperties, one word.
Yeah.
Perfect. So go and check that, and that's on Instagram. Do you guys active on anything else other than Instagram at the moment?
Just
no dating.
It's where
sites,
everyone is.
No, that's it.
You got a kid on the way.
Yeah.
You got to get him without. Okay, so go and check these guys out, Colossal LA. Also, guys, in the comment section, if there's anything that we haven't answered today or anything that's actually come up in the conversation where you're like, I'd like to know some more information on that, put a comment down, send us an email, whatever it is, and we'll reach out to Colossal and just see actually if you have the time, because it sounds like you guys just don't at the moment, to answer some questions. In fact, I'd like to leave it just with maybe a last thought. If you were listening to this right now, back in 2008 and you're kind of thinking, I want to get into development, real estate, and you would like to be where you are now and what you're doing, are there any kind of thoughts with hindsight that you would like to pass on to someone, or advice that you'd say, this is something that if you're wanting to do this?
Yeah, you just need to find a way to get involved in the construction side.
Construction side.
Whether you own the property or you have a friend who owns the property, or you know, find someone who's building properties and just need to get involved and learn the process.
So shadowing someone, interning,
something like that.
Finding a mentor.
Get involved and see how it happens day to day.
Because I suppose that's something that you just can't learn.
Yeah, you can't
any other way.
Learn, and then after that, learning how to budget and learning what things cost.
Awesome. I love it. Yeah. All right.
And then I'd like to add just creativity and problem solving.
Problem solving.
That's the key. I think that a lot of people, you'll always incur something that's a problem and people stick their hands up and say, I don't know how to solve it.
Yeah.
But just find a solution and move forward.
Because the buck stops with you when you're doing it and you're at the top of the ladder. Yeah. Okay, guys. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Just to give you guys a recap, Philip Braunstein and Clark Braunstein, we've been very lucky to be invited to their office here at the moment. And we will be visiting a couple of their sites next week. We also may have some kind of influencer exposure to some of their actual properties that they've built, which I'm really excited about. But if you guys have any ideas, any questions, or if there's any actual topics that have come up today that you'd like us to readdress, definitely reach out, send us a comment, and we would love to do it. Thank you so much, guys, because actually it's just fascinating for me from my perspective to actually get your side of what your day-to-day is as well. But anyway, guys, have a great day wherever you are, and subscribe, tune in, and let us know what you would like to hear from us next. All right, guys, bye-bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.